In France today, a group of young people take European countries to court. The charge? The people running the show are destroying the planet and not doing enough to address climate change.
They wanted to do something about it. Otherwise, their future would be one which would be unlivable.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also ahead, the UN's Convention on Refugees was established in 1951. Today, there are growing calls for change and pushback to that.
It's not a perfect instrument by any means, but it's better than anything we would likely to get.
Plus, an astronaut breaks the American space record. More than a year in orbit takes its toll.
The human body does not like being in space for long periods of time. It doesn't like being in reduced gravity, so it affects many systems.
That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us today. In Strasbourg, France today, a new climate case launched at the European Court of Human Rights. Six young people from Portugal, aged 11 to 24, made their case before stoic-robed judges. They're suing 32 European countries for failing to address human-caused climate change. They say inaction has violated their human rights. One of their lawyers is Gerard O'Quinn. He's the director of the Global Legal Action Network. We reached him in Strasbourg as he was leaving the courtroom. Gerard, what happened in court today?
Well, today was an unprecedented attempt to hold 32 countries accountable for their climate emissions, which are impacting on the lives of the six young applicants who we're supporting in bringing this case. And in court today, we heard the states really concentrate on technicalities. They were trying to have the case dismissed without ever having their own policies scrutinized by the court. But I think it was also a really amazing opportunity to reiterate the concrete impacts these young people are experiencing. So we're talking about heat extremes that interfere with basic things like exercise, spending time outdoors, sleep, concentration, increasing heat waves in Portugal. It's a very climate vulnerable country. And we're seeing huge increases in mortality and morbidity. And at the same time, the other thing we witnessed today in court were the countries trivializing these things, saying there's a lot of predictions we don't know, borderline climate denialism.
Your clients are all from Portugal. What's motivating them? Can you tell me about a few of the clients?
They're from two different families. Some of them were in school when they first started this. Others have started work. And they've been building this diligently over the last 6 years. We first engaged with these young people after the 2017 wildfires, which unfortunately resulted in many deaths. And they saw firsthand the devastation that was being wrought on their region, where climate change was deepening the impacts of these fires and their frequency. And these fires came right up to their towns. They were covered in ash, and it was quite a shock. And they realized that summer on summer, this was only getting worse. They just lived through another temperature setting summer, and they wanted to do something about it. Otherwise, their future would be one which would be unlivable. And today was a momentous day. They've achieved a lot by standing steadfast.
As you well know, there are thousands of climate cases out there, though this is one of the biggest. Why do you think this has potential to have a big impact?
It's before a court that has jurisdiction over in excess of 47 countries, I believe, within the Council of Europe. And this case is against the major emitters. So really, we're talking about a significant chunk of global emissions in the first case. It's also a highly influential court, which could influence the decisions of other international bodies and national courts, especially those in Europe, which would equip them to go further in addressing the climate crisis.
And what do the young people at the center of this case have to prove to make the court rule in their favor?
We're able to show that there's a direct causal connection between the emissions of these 32 countries and direct climate change impacts that they're experiencing. So proving their victim status is a key element of this, and also proving that they fall within the jurisdiction of these 32 states by virtue of these emissions.
Now, I know there was a somewhat similar case brought before a different EU court back in 2018 that was thrown out because the plaintiffs couldn't make the case that they were specifically impacted by climate change in a way that was different from anyone else, I gather. Why do you think that this case might end differently?
I think this might end differently because of the extreme vulnerability of the region in which these young people are located. So the harm is very specific, identifiable, and each of them have different characteristics. One is a bronchoasthmatic, another has certain allergies, conditions which are exacerbated by the climate crisis. And I think we also have a good degree of foresight on the parts of the governments. There's a deep understanding amongst these governments about the impact of climate change and how fossil fuel emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, are contributing to them. Moreover, we've also presented evidence about how feasible it is for the governments to change course. So we've said the governments can do more, but they're choosing not to. So this raises questions for the states. They know the harms, they know they're creating harms, they're contributing directly to them, but they're choosing not to take a different path. If we remain on course and we go to 3 degrees of warming, all of Europe will be impacted and everyone will have victim status. So I think it becomes a question of, if not now, when will the governments act?
Gerard O'Quinn is the director of the Global Legal Action Network. He's been speaking to us from Strasbourg, France. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
2 months ago, you might remember hearing about this, a U.S. soldier sprinted across a heavily fortified border into North Korea. The last thing heard from Army Private Travis King was his laughter. Today, North Korea released King. And for more on this story, we turn to Jenny Town. She's the director of 38 North, a publication from the Stimson Center think tank that focuses on North Korea. Jenny, what do we know about why North Korea is releasing Travis King today?
Well, we don't know a lot. There is some things that we can kind of surmise from all of this. What we've been able to piece together of this story is that he had actually been arrested in South Korea, served a little bit of jail time for assault for like a bar fight or something, and was being sent back to the U.S. for disciplinary action. And then instead of getting on the plane, somehow made it back to the city, got on a tour to the DMZ, and then while he was in the joint security area, ran to the north. The initial readouts from the North Korean interviews of him as to why he said he was going, he did talk about feeling a lot of discrimination in the U.S. Army. He was a soldier. He is a soldier, a second-class private, and sort of, you know, disillusionment with the United States and with the U.S. Army. That's what we've been able to piece together. How accurate that is, we just don't know.
Does it strike you as unusual that North Korea released this prisoner relatively quickly? It sounds like you're saying you did not expect them to hold him for very long because there isn't much precedent for this, but it was only about 2 months.
Yeah, no, I think there were many of us in the community that thought he might have been returned even sooner. Mm. I think some of the delay of why it took 2 months, I think there was some level of quarantine that happened that delayed the process. And then there was the high level visits also going on of Russian and Chinese officials into North Korea that I think, you know, took precedence over dealing with Private King's case. But yeah, you know, for a lot of us who work on North Korea issues, there just didn't seem to be a lot of potential value to the North Koreans that Private King offered. He wasn't like a high-level military asset. He, you know, didn't have a super compelling soldier story. This seemed like a lot of liability for them to accept him with very little payoff at a time when there's already fragile relations going on. So I think a lot of us expected him to be returned relatively quickly.
Mm. You mentioned fragile relations. Is there anything in the current U.S.-North Korea relationship at the moment that sheds light on why King, you know, was in fact released?
Well, there's not much going on between the U.S. and North Korea these days in terms of actual diplomacy. You know, we haven't been in formal talks since 2019. The U.S. has been offering talks about denuclearization several times since Biden came into office. And then the North Koreans have rejected that over and over and over. But there has been still contact, pretty regular contact between United Nations Command and the North Koreans. Just to check in, and you know, there's at least one channel of communication that's still open. And the UNC did sort of take the lead on this because it did happen in the demilitarized zone. There isn't really much going on, but at the same time, like, this wasn't an issue that was worth agitating relations any further.
Jenny Town is the director of 38 North, a publication from the Stimson Center that focuses on North Korea. Jenny, thanks for all of this.
Thanks, Carolyn. It was great.
South Sudan has been an independent country for only a dozen years after a long civil war. But the country is now celebrating a big moment. It's sending the national basketball team, the Bright Stars, to the Olympics. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi has our story.
Growing up as a South Sudanese refugee in Minnesota, Anunwa Omot would gaze at the fire station across the street from his home and dream about becoming a fireman. An Olympic athlete, though? Never, he tells me. But clearly, fate has other plans for him, because the Olympics is where he and South Sudan's national basketball team are headed next summer.
Where we going? Paris! Where we going? Paris!
The Bright Stars national team is headed to Paris. Earlier this month, they clinched a spot at the Olympics after a series of wins at the FIBA Basketball World Cup. For a team that was just established a few years ago, this has brought both jubilation and some shock, Omot tells me.
For me, honestly, I've been overwhelmed with everything that's happened and how it's happened. For me, it's just, you know, it's a blessing just to be able to be in this situation.
Omot's basketball journey began in high school. It clicked for him, and he decided to try going professional. But the years since have been rocky, and he says many people doubted him. Things changed a few years ago, though, when he got a call from legendary retired NBA All-Star Luol Deng, who's also originally from South Sudan.
It was a no-brainer when he called and mentioned what he had planned and what he wanted to do, how he seen it unfolding.
Deng's vision was to bring together South Sudanese basketball players from across the world to build a winning team and grow the sport of basketball in his home country. When Omot joined the Bright Stars, he realized that it wasn't just about him.
When I noticed the impact that it was serving towards, you know, the younger generation in the country, that's when I was just like, wow, this is bigger than basketball, you know?
The South Sudan Basketball Federation was formed just a few years ago to help make South Sudan a basketball country. But not everyone was on board with this vision, says Aru Ramadan Chan, its deputy secretary general. He says at the beginning, there wasn't much support or investment for the federation.
When we started knocking doors to all different donors, all different NGOs and different companies and the government to give us support, nobody could listen to us.
In fact, the national team, Chan says, was initially bankrolled by Luol Deng himself and the players and coaches who have given their time for free. He says they are all motivated by the same things.
We are working towards something greater than basketball, which is the narrative of a whole nation.
The national team's recent accomplishments have brought a lot of pride among South Sudanese.
We are South Sudan! We are South Sudan! We are South Sudan! We are South Sudan!
Seeing fans turn up for big games helps motivate Anunwa Omot and his teammates. And that's especially important during the difficult times. Because of security issues and a lack of sports infrastructure in South Sudan, the team can't practice there.
Access to gym space obviously is non-existent because we don't have an indoor facility. So we actually have to go to, you know, we had camp in Australia.
Improving the sports infrastructure in South Sudan is at the top of the agenda for the Basketball Federation, according to Chan. But he says qualifying for the Olympics has brought more support and potential investors. I ask him, given all the political and security challenges in his country right now, how does he pitch investing in basketball of all things? He says the game is a unifier in a country that still struggles with ethnic divisions.
A group of different people from different corners of the country, and we play as one. We become more united as a people.
He adds that basketball has become hugely popular in South Sudan. From tea stalls to camps for displaced people, everyone is talking about hoops these days. And as the Bright Stars prepare to compete in the Paris Olympics next year, he says interest in basketball will only get bigger. For the World, I'm Halima Gakandi in Nairobi.
Coming up, one astronaut's long stay at the International Space Station has come to an end. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. A NASA astronaut made history today.
Frank Rubio, the U.S. record holder for the longest single space flight in history, back on Earth.
Frank Rubio was up in space for 371 days, a new American record, and twice as long as he expected to be up there. He returned to Earth today along with two Russian cosmonauts. His record comes as the U.S. and Russia continue to cooperate at the ISS despite Russia's invasion of Ukraine. To sketch out what that cooperation looks like right now, we're joined by Chris Johnson. He's a space law advisor with the Secure World Foundation. Chris, Frank Rubio was up in space way longer than he thought he'd be. What happened?
You know, when I talk about human spaceflight, you can just expect the unexpected, plan that your plans will change. It was essentially mechanical problems, a coolant leak, which caused them to delay the return of astronauts. But, you know, the astronauts on ISS are well aware of how to extend stays. And so, you know, he got the chance to set a world record, or at least an American spaceflight record for, you know, longest time in space.
And I'm curious, what does it do to somebody's body being up in space for that long?
It does a whole lot. And most of it is bad. Essentially, you know, the human body does not like being in space for long periods of time. It doesn't like being in reduced gravity. So it affects many systems.
So the U.S. and Russia have continued to cooperate in space, obviously. Has there been any bumpiness in that relationship since the war in Ukraine started?
The NASA partners and the ISS partners really protect and treasure and cherish and value the sanctity of human spaceflight. When we think about the ISS, continually inhabited low Earth orbit installation, likely the most expensive thing that has ever been created by humanity, likely the most complex piece of equipment that we have ever created. Both the U.S. and Russia realize that it is something that should not be affected by what is happening between states on the ground.
A little more than a year ago, Russia announced that it was pulling out of the International Space Station program and would build its own version. That seems vital here. What would that mean for future international cooperation in space?
I think that ISS has served its purpose, at least its geopolitical purposes, of tying Cold War and post-Cold War powers together. But I think when the U.S. and the Russians look to the future and look to beyond low Earth orbit, when they look to their lunar ambitions, they think, I think we've done enough with that partner in low Earth orbit. Let's try and wrap it up and make sure that it's safely wrapped up. But, you know, we're willing to go to the end of this decade. But beyond that, at the end of the ISS, likely 2030, 2031, I think that the Americans will choose different partners for beyond low Earth orbit, and I think the Russians also will choose different partners.
So eventually, when the U.S.-Russia cooperation ends in lower Earth orbit, at least, what exactly will be lost?
So what will be lost is that we have been tied to the other space agencies, and Russia and America are tied to each other in this international space agency, which is really what the ISS is. It ties us together at a deep fundamental level, just like I would say, you know, NATO partners are tied together. They may have their squabbles, administrations may come and go, but at a fundamental level, they are tied together like this. We can be nervous about a post-ISS where America and Russia do not have this deep scientific codependency and mutual commitment to each other.
Chris Johnson is a space law advisor with the Secure World Foundation. He joined us from Leiden in the Netherlands discussing the space news today that one American astronaut and two Russian cosmonauts have returned safely to Earth from the International Space Station. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
In recent days, the number of people crossing the U.S. border from Mexico has spiked. On Monday, more than 8,000 migrants came across the southern border, according to U.S. officials. Authorities in the U.S. and Mexico are taking steps to slow the pace of crossings, steps that are also having an impact on commercial cross-border trade. The world's TB Saiseya is here to help us understand what's happening. TB, what's going on at the border this week?
Yeah, so because of the rising numbers of migrants crossing the southern border, U.S. authorities have decided to close an important bridge that connects El Paso in Texas with the Mexican city of Ciudad Juarez, so that agents that used to carry out cargo inspections can now process migrants. And this bridge is very busy with commercial truck traffic, and that has now completely stopped. That's one thing. But on top of this, the Texas Department of Public Safety is doing more detailed inspections of trucks on another important bridge in the same area. That's because migrants have been trying to get into the U.S. by hiding inside tractor trailers. So these inspections are slowing down truck crossings. And right now, the line of trucks backed up in one area across El Paso is around 6 miles long.
Wow, that's really snarling up trade between the U.S. and Mexico then, it sounds like.
The numbers are huge, Caroline. There are 8,000 trailers carrying close to $1 billion worth of goods that are now stuck on the Mexican side. And they've been there for more than a week. Here's one example. These delays forced a Canadian auto manufacturer to suspend production this week at 3 factories in Ciudad Juárez, right next to El Paso. They employ around 9,000 people who are now staying home. Some companies have been redirecting trucks to other border cities in New Mexico and Arizona.
Real-world impacts on those factories. Okay, so TB, we've been talking about road routes here. I understand that Mexico has also suspended a number of cargo train routes that cross the country. Is this also related to the flow of migrants?
That is right, Caroline. A company that operates some of Mexico's railways suspended a total of 60 routes because there's been an important surge of migrants hitching rides on the roof of cargo trains. And migrants have been doing this for years, but Mexican authorities said the numbers are unprecedented now, and they suspended the most common routes used by migrants to avoid accidents and loss of life.
TB, you've done some reporting in the past about these cargo trains, people hitching rides on the roof. Just how dangerous is that?
It's extremely dangerous. There are a lot of cases where people have suffered amputations or have been killed from falls or being run over by the trains. I have talked to people who have done this, and they all say it's hard to board on a moving train. Also, you may have trouble when the train goes under a bridge or with signposts or anything that is right next to the train. And also, you travel for several days exposed to the element. But migrants keep doing this to save money and time on their northbound trips.
So what's the long-term plan for these train routes and for those truck traffic routes across the border that you were talking about earlier? I imagine a lot of what we've been talking about is hurting Mexico's economy, too.
It is hurting Mexican economy, but we've seen in the past that the Mexican government has moved a lot of agents along the train route, and the trains will end up traveling without any migrants on them for a while. But those operations tend to be against surges, and surges historically come and go. And also, it is disrupting commercial activities, so it is very unlikely that this route will remain closed for the long term. What is sure is that this, along with the bridge closures, is going to hurt the Mexican economy. And previous slowdowns like this in the U.S.-Mexico border have resulted in billions of dollars in total losses.
Billions, wow. The World's TB Saizea, thank you so much for the update on the problem with cargo traffic at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Thank you.
More global news still ahead. You are listening to The World. Monkey King is a popular Chinese folk story about a rambunctious monkey. And now it's also an opera for American audiences.
I tried to distill it into a way that Americans could relate to.
A new updated tale of a spiritual journey ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Fashion moves fast these days. Many brands don't just churn out new clothes every season. They do it seemingly every other week. The demand for new styles is intense. Designers comb the streets and the internet, taking inspiration wherever they can. But as The World's Patrick Wynn reports, some fashion firms take more than that, lifting designs from indigenous artisans without giving them a cent.
The highlands of Southeast Asia, up in the north of Vietnam, Thailand, and Laos, are lush and green, with mountains often shrouded in fog. They're diverse, too. Each valley can be home to a distinct ethnicity. Among the smallest groups, with fewer than 3,000 people, are the Oma. Many Oma women are embroidery masters. When they're not busy farming rice or tending buffalo, they perfect their art, stitching strikingly beautiful indigo dresses. Not many outsiders ever see their work. So, when an Oma village chief got a text message one day with a photo of a European woman wearing an Oma dress. That was strange. The chief rushed to show the rest of the village, and at first, they were amused.
We sent him a picture and share with the artisans there, and they still, oh, it's beautiful, you know, it's very nice.
Gamchan Suwanalit is the guy who sent the picture. He goes by Ton, and he's with the Traditional Arts and Ethnology Center, a nonprofit based in Luang Prabang, Laos. When Ton later reached the Oma village, a 9-hour trek, partly up winding dirt roads, they'd had a chance to really look over the dress in that photo. And the amusement had worn off.
They said, oh, this is not right. We want them to fix it.
We want them to fix it, he said. Whoever made this dress, dark blue with a red hem, botched it. It had this looping design, like the tendrils of a fern, blatantly copied from their work, he said. That swirling motif is for a married woman's headpiece, a sacred object. But on this dress, it was on the bottom, below the waist, down by the feet, big cultural violation. The women asked Ton, who made this? He said a name that they'd never heard before, Max Mara.
I'm a woman. I'm confident and beautiful. I'm creative and powerful. I am Max Mara.
Max Mara is a billion-dollar global corporation based in Italy. The dress, from their summer 2019 line, sold for about $400. That's about half a year's pay for many Oma people. How designers at Max Mara came across Oma clothing is a mystery.
When it came out, there was nothing saying this was the Oma or even the Asian or tribal line, you know, which is what some designers do.
Tara Gujidar co-founded the Traditional Arts and Ethnology Center in Laos. She collects examples of fashion companies taking inspiration from indigenous people. This week, the center opened an exhibition in Luang Prabang of other violations. A French fashion designer copying a cape made by Purepecha people in Mexico, beadwork by the Maasai people of Kenya, replicated by Louis Vuitton. It happens a lot, Gujidar says. And in each case, the corporations could have at least sought permission.
They instead said, we were inspired by these cultures. This was an homage to these cultures. But the designs that they ended up producing were really just copies.
The world reached out to Max Mara, but got no reply. Max Mara, in a statement to another news outlet, said it was completely unaware the Oma design, quote, may be part of Oma traditional craftsmanship, and that it didn't do anything illegal, which seems to be true. The Versace logo and the Nike swoosh are copyright protected, but most indigenous designs have no such protections. The Oma don't have intellectual property lawyers to defend them. They ply their trade in thatch roof houses, where women dye their dresses in clay pots, passing down their culture from old to young. Gujidar says the indigenous Hmong people, also native to Laos, also have their motifs copied all the time. It ends up on Amazon, she says. These are designs that may have meaning in Hmong culture printed on a bedsheet.
I think they usually call them tribal designs, but they're really just Hmong designs that have been printed onto fabric.
Want to profit from indigenous artists? A company should seek consent, she says. Give credit and compensation. Mr. Ton has heard the same comment from the Oma over and over to Max Mara using their designs.
If the company wants to use it, you have to ask for permission first, and then they can work together.
The Oma say, hire us, learn from us, share the profits, so we can all prosper. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen.
The British Home Secretary was in Washington yesterday. The topic of the day, migration.
The global asylum framework is a promissory note that the West cannot fulfill.
Suella Braverman spoke at Washington's American Enterprise Institute. She said the record number of asylum seekers crossing the English Channel and the U.S. southern border was partly the result of what she called an outdated agreement. That would be the 1951 United Nations Refugee Convention.
We have created a system of almost infinite supply, incentivizing millions of people to try their luck, knowing full well that we have no capacity to meet more than a fraction of the demand.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees responded in a statement saying the backlog was caused by slow decision-making procedures. We wanted to look back at what this agreement was in 1951 and how it still works today. For that, we turned to Karen Jacobson, a professor of global migration at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Karen, what does the Refugee Convention call on nations to do?
Basically, it's asking countries who have signed the convention, of which there are about 149 countries today, to abide by a set of treaty obligations to assist refugees, to enable them to live safely in the country, in the host country, and eventually to qualify potentially for citizenship or more permanent status in the country.
And how was it implemented back in 1951? Can you paint us a picture of who the refugees were then?
Well, basically, the convention was set up after the Second World War, when there were some 2 million people displaced within Europe. So it was originally intended not to last very long, because it was assumed that these problems from the Second World War would be taken care of quite quickly. But in fact, more refugees continued to, you know, there were more refugee flows. Particularly in 1956, the Hungarian Revolution created a large flow of refugees. So these refugee movements continued. And in 1967, a protocol was added to the convention. The additional protocol extends the same protections to refugees throughout the world.
These days, on the U.S. southern border, on the English Channel, on Italy's Mediterranean coast, people are continually arriving, seeking entrance. And there is pushback from populist politicians to deny asylum seekers. There's also these things we've been hearing about called pushbacks. Are there aspects of the Refugee Convention that no longer fit today's circumstances, as some of these politicians allege?
You know, I don't think that's the case. I mean, we have processes, we have legal processes in place already for taking care of these problems, but the devil is in the implementation, because if there aren't adequate resources given to the courts and to the bureaucracies and officials who are supposed to, you know, vet who's coming across the border, then, of course, we'll have politicians who say they're just too many and they're, you know, frauds and so forth. But there are definitely issues that need to be changed. The problem is that if we start changing the convention now, it is much more likely that it will be substantially weakened, because there is so much pushback from the kinds of politicians that you mentioned. So that is why, even though many of us in this field criticize the convention and worry that it's inadequate today, we're much more worried that if we tried to change it, it would become worse, it would become more restrictive for the people who really need those protections.
Yeah, I've heard that worry before. But what do you see as the problems of the convention that you would renegotiate if you think it actually would work?
Well, there are several. There are some of the protections, you know, that people are eligible for, they're not complete enough. For example, gender persecution, the persecution of women, persecution of LGBTQI people, the persecution of different ethnic groups and so forth. These are all groups of people who are not adequately recognized in the convention. And so even countries that have signed the convention, you know, are some of the worst persecutors of people in those groups. So the convention in some sense is not complete enough. It doesn't address enough of the membership in particular groups that should be addressed.
What is the risk of trying to change the convention to solve the problems you see?
I think the risk is that what's likely to happen is we'll get a less solid, a less useful instrument. You know, there are many more countries now than there were that signed the convention back in 1951. And it's very unlikely that those countries would come together and come up with an instrument that truly addresses the world's people who are fleeing conflict, disaster, persecution, and so forth. It would become a much more politicized document than it was, than it is now. And it's very unlikely there'd be any consensus. It would be a race to the bottom, to the lowest possible set of obligations that states could come up with together, and likely probably it would never pass. I can't even imagine that we would ever get anything reasonable from the UN General Assembly, or, you know, there'd just be too many obstacles to passing something that was better than what we have now.
Karen Jacobson is a professor of global migration at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. She was helping us understand the 1951 United Nations Refugee Convention and how it applies today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Researchers digging into Spain's civil war from the 1930s are using new technologies and old archives to search for lost foreign fighters. Some 35,000 volunteer soldiers came from across Europe and the Americas to join Spain's international brigades. They were defending the Republican government against a fascist rebellion led by General Francisco Franco. The Republic fell and thousands of brigadiers were killed. The World's Jerry Haddon reports on the search for their graves along the Ebro River in Spain's northeast.
In the summer of 1938, this wooded ridge high above the Ebro became the bloodiest battlefield of the Civil War. Bombs and bullets tore through the trees, killing thousands. Today, archaeologists are digging out the old trenches, unearthing the bones. Elderly folk have come by, says lead archaeologist Marina San Juan, telling us how this mountain reeked of death at war's end. Despite all the decades that have passed, she says, there are still so many bones up here. The carnage, she says, is just incalculable. San Juan and her small team have been up here for weeks, clearing the earth, slowly exposing a warren of shallow trenches and protruding from them the remains of the fallen, ribs, femurs, the odd skull. Investigators are finding more and more sites like these and more human remains, thanks in part to new technology. Like this drone they've kitted out with ground-penetrating radar. Once they locate remains, they try to figure out where they're from. Are they Spanish or foreign? San Juan says without a lucky break, it's often next to impossible to tell. Sometimes we find a clue, she says, maybe a button. On a recent dig nearby, she says, we found a coin from the Weimar Republic, which indicates there were foreign soldiers here.
Because in the Battle of the Ebro, soldiers from all around Spain and all around the world came.
Alfonso Aragoneses heads Catalonia's Historic Memory Project, which oversees the searches.
They were very young. Many of them didn't have children, so they have no descendants. So we know it's very difficult to find families.
Families that might provide, say, DNA samples or maybe old letters from brigadiers that offer clues to their fates. Making the search tougher, Spanish war records themselves are often incomplete, with brigadiers' names omitted from recruitment papers. Yet in just the last couple of years, Aragonese's team has identified, by name, some 357 fallen brigadiers, so far mostly from Germany and Austria.
If you have the correct links, you can try to find information about a lot of fighters.
Researcher Julie Cuellar shows me how. He takes me inside what's probably the most detailed international brigades archive in the world. Up until a couple of years ago, it was virtually inaccessible because it's in Moscow, in the Russian Archive of Social and Political History. The Soviets backed Spain's leftist republic during the war, sending advisors, a few planes, and a lot of spies to monitor brigadiers. They kept copious notes, says Cuellar. For over 80 years, this trove of data sat on shelves. It wasn't put online and made public until 2021.
Es una fuente primordial para encontrar datos sobre...
It's a primary source of intel on the combatants, says Cuellar, switching to Spanish. The files are filled with personal details. The Communist Party would then send that info back to Moscow, he says. The archives also contain details on brigade movements, the wounded and those killed, and their names. By cross-referencing that with the Spanish records, Cuellar says, they're slowly but surely confirming foreign fighters' identities and zeroing in on where they might lie, like up on that ridge above the Ebro. Finding them can bring peace to victims' families. In a cemetery an hour up the Ebro River, relatives of one fallen brigadier gather at his graveside. They're honoring Welshman Harry Dobson, killed in 1938. They sing and set out a black marble plaque that bears his photo.
This is something that I promised a long time ago. I'm happy as hell about it.
Dobson's aging nephew, Raymond Gleason, has come from Birmingham for the ceremony. He says this memorial will keep his uncle's memory alive.
The last battle of the Ebro, there was a machine gun fire, and apparently he was taken back to the Cave Hospital where he passed away. Yes, absolutely ordinary, not educated to any degree, but a wonderful, wonderful person that hoped and died for freedom.
For families of foreign fighters who are still missing, the Catalan government has set up a DNA database. It's encouraging people to sign up, no matter where they are in the world, because every new match will mean another brigadier's bones can finally be laid to rest. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon on the Ebro River, Spain.
A popular Chinese folktale from the 16th century is being adapted for new audiences. Monkey King is the story of a rambunctious monkey that conquers demons to grow spiritually. He's joined by travel companions along the way. In August, Netflix released a cartoon version of the fable.
Monkey King reigns supreme!
You are crazy!
And handsome!
There's also an opera version of the Monkey King story. It draws inspiration from many different cultures. The World's Sara Hassan went to the rehearsal just before the world premiere in Boston.
It's a famous story from China that became popular across the region over the years. Monkey King, A Journey to the West, is a 16th century Chinese folktale. The original features four main characters, with Monkey, who joins a monk on an important journey, along with a pig and a sandwoman, all trying to repair their own spiritual shortcomings. Over the weekend, a unique performance by White Snake Projects debuted its world premiere called Monkey, a Kung Fu Puppet Parable. Cerise Lim Jacobs, originally from Singapore, who wrote the script, says the epic story makes up four giant volumes, so she had to choose what to include.
I tried to figure out the essential elements of the story and distill it into a way that Americans could relate to and enjoy and be provoked by, in the sense of bringing up a lot of different things to think about.
She not only blended the traditional with the modern, but Jacobs also intentionally chose a diverse cast and creative team. This includes Mexican-American composer Jorge Sosa.
You can hear the inflections of Chinese music, of Mexican Latin music. You can hear American pop culture. You can hear rock culture. And move the focus of opera away from being Eurocentric to a more realistic depiction of what America is.
The puppets used in the production are a style of bunraku puppetry from Japan. As for the characters on stage, Zhu the pig is Caucasian American and Sha the sandwoman is Latina. Monkey is performed by Chinese countertenor Chuan Yuan Liu. He's from northeast China and grew up with the story of Monkey.
There were plenty of medias that you can choose from, really, from novel, abridged novel, TV shows, cartoons, movies, all that kind of stuff. And so it's a huge part of my childhood.
He says the story was mandatory reading in schools. Liu came to the United States from China when he was 18. He says he didn't know anything about classical music at the time and was getting a degree in computer science. But his love for singing prompted him to join the university choir.
And by the end of my third year in college, I was like, I kind of want to do this.
He ended up going to the Bard College Conservatory of Music in upstate New York and then getting an artist diploma from the University of Cincinnati. So it was only natural for him to be a part of the production.
When I was approached, I was so thrilled to be part of this project.
Liu sings in a rare high register.
I am monkey.
A countertenor is a biologically male singer singing in a traditionally female register.
It tries to recreate how a castrato singer would have sounded in the 17th century. The storyline of Monkey may sound familiar to an American audience, says Cerise Lim Jacobs.
I found out that that American classic, Wizard of Oz, is actually based on Journey to the West. In fact, it's the exact story with different characters and different times and different space, but it's the identical story.
In The Wizard of Oz, you have Dorothy on a quest to find the Emerald City so she can get home.
And along the way, she meets three misfits, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion. And they each have some deficiency that they perceive they have.
In the original Monkey story, they battle many demons along the way, which are represented in the opera by Mara, who mirrors the Wicked Witch of the West. And they're encouraged by Guan Yin, like Glinda, the Good Witch. Monkey's role is to protect the monk on his journey to retrieve the Buddhist sutras, or religious texts, from India so he can spread the teachings in China. Roxana Myram, a director for the opera, is Buddhist herself. She was drawn to the faith in college and spent a summer at a monastery in Taiwan, so the production has special significance for her.
I think one of the things that really stood out to me about this story and that resonated with the teachings of Buddhism is how Monkey finds his way into being part of a community where he's essentially learning to use his powers for good.
In the opera, Monkey ends up choosing his own path. That message of diversity is also employed in the many mediums used for the production. The Bunraku style of puppetry has puppeteers on stage directly working the figures. They're dressed in black to blend into the background, so the focus is on the puppets. The production also uses computer-generated technology through CGI environs and avatars to provide backdrops and to augment the performance.
It's been really a fun time learning the role, performing it, and seeing it being so much layered in this operatic form, having puppetry, having voiceover. It's like all those little medias that I grew up with kind of come true one by one. And it's just really, really fun to kind of present this to a general audience.
For The World, I'm Sara Hassan in Boston.
I'm a monk journeying west to seek the sutras.
That's The World for today. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Goodbye, and be good to each other out there.
From PRX.